Go slow to go fast, I think, is the way. Keep asking the right questions. Keep putting yourself in the right places. Keep doing the feedback loops and then start to chip away, chip down.
You're listening to This Much I Know, the Seed Camp podcast.
Welcome, everyone. I'm really excited to have a longtime friend, longtime supporter of Seed Camps, Chris Topman, who is founder of not only Included VC, but also co-founder of Notion Capital, one of the leading, especially in cybersecurity and SaaS and other enterprise software investment firms here based in London. We're co-investors in several companies. But what's really cool is that in his LinkedIn profile, he has not only as co-founder, but chief commercial officer of Message Labs. And it says, and I'm going to read it because it's too cool, the idea creation and then domination of the category of messaging security before selling to Symantec for $700 million-boom, exclamation mark. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Carlos. Great to be here and see you. Excited to talk to you. I'm halfway through your book at the moment.
Thank you.
Which is, I think, version 2, maybe even you said to me earlier that version 3 might be out soon. So yeah.
Yes.
I'm already going to be out of date.
No. You add a zero to the numbers. Inflation. Lots has changed since early days venture in Europe, hasn't it?
Oh, totally. I think one of the interesting parts about our history, the Notion founders' history, is that we announced Notion the day after we sold Message Labs, which is very typical for us. That we've just, everyone's shaken hands and everyone's excited about cementing a new deal. And we kind of almost like issue the divorce papers. You know, we're heading towards this kind of portfolio play of investing in these emerging SaaS businesses, which in the end of 2008, 2009 was somewhat embryonic. I think B2B SaaS as a percentage of IT spend was probably maybe 1%. We believed it would be 50% in our lifetime. So there's going to be this huge transition of capital that goes from software, hardware, systems integrator spend to these new, shiny, exciting, built from the ground up to live on the cloud type companies. So that was the original thought process. And we were very, very excited about that. But when you arrive in the venture capital world, it actually felt a little bit like going backwards because you built this global business with people all around the world. And then you'd arrived in London as a VC and like everyone's, you know, mail, everyone's proprietary around their data and who they talk to. And there's me thinking, this is weird. It's like going back in time. And I actually, Seedcamp, I thought, was just this incredible forcing mechanism to force people to kind of collaborate. We'd turn up at London Business School or something and there'd be founders, operators, investors, all playing with each other in terms of mentoring or allyship or, you know, is this the right company for me? So I think our shared journey has been phenomenal, I think. Yeah. And such a huge respect for what you've done.
Well, thank you. I mean,
not only as investors, but also in the ecosystem, I think.
I appreciate that. I think one of the fun things is that we're seeing that being rekindled with Included VC, which we'll touch upon shortly. But I wanted to go a little bit backwards in time to 1999, to the beginning of Message Labs, to your background, just as a very quick retrospective. Well, first of all, what were you doing before Message Labs? Like, what did you study? How did you guys come together to build this? And what were the biggest sort of highs and lows of that journey?
Well, that's actually a very good question to precursor Included, actually. So I am, in essence, a very normal working class guy from the wrong side of the tracks, born in Dagenham in the east end of London. I left school at 16. I have not even sixth form, you know, no further education. And I managed to get on a youth training scheme into investment banking, or I would say trading, the trading part, in 85. So I'm 55. So it's a, you know, quite a long career history, started earlier than most of my peers that I sit in board meetings with. And I had a riot. It was like, you know, I was on the runner in the life market. There was still open outcry trading. Big bang happened. So deregulation of the city, And it was that time that I realized I was kind of wired a little bit differently. And so, which translates to there's a type of kind of dyslexia that I have, which makes me quite restless, makes me quite experimental, makes me kind of link information in unusual ways. It's more of a kind of storage problem or difference that I have. So I have a very, very low short-term memory recall. So I tend to chunk information together. And so I make linkages of information in an unusual way. And so, so I think that pushes me towards the kind of innovator mode, the experimenter mode, thinking about things should be done differently, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, I had spent a time in the city and investment banking and then broader financial services. And then Joss White, who's the other co-founder of Notion, and his brother, Ben, who was the original founder of Message Labs. Ben and I were great mates from that background. And he kept banging on the door saying, look, I want you to get into technology. I want you to get into technology. And I kept saying no. And he kept not taking no for an answer. And then so finally, in 97, I said I'd do a few days a month consulting. And I just thought it was, you know, it wasn't what I expected. I thought there was just opportunity everywhere in technology at that point in time. At this point, they'd already sold a business, which was the biggest system distributor in Europe. That was the hardware to build the IP networks. Then people were going to join this. Ben really didn't like the hardware business. So he was building an ISP, an internet service provider, connecting SMEs to the internet and packaging technology together. They're incredible. His whole family are incredible at packaging technology together or bundling products together. And there was this moment in time where customers that were really just having their first experience of the internet said, it was third on the customer list of needs. Could you stop us getting these things called viruses? And you could see the technologists, the techies in the room, they were fidgeting about wanting to solve this problem rather than the first problem or the second problem. And that ultimately, 3 or 4 months later, became an alpha that we switched on, which was virus scanning for email at the internet level, because we had networked data centers. We could put the filtering in the central infrastructure, if you like, of the internet. And as soon as we switched it on, we knew we'd hit internet like oil. It was a phenomenal moment, a moment that you want all your founders to have, you know. And then it became the this was bundled in for free, by the way. So the free alpha sort of beta became, you know, this $150 million subscription business in about 8 years. So
we'll unpack that in the chapter on how to price and package the software in your book when we come back to it later. But yeah. Carry on, please.
Yeah, so that was it. And then it was like holding the tail of the tiger, because we knew it was a global opportunity. It was any email user, but which do you then decide where, you know, you have limited resources. Where do you focus and how do you go to market? And it certainly wasn't in the ISP. So Ben and Joss really made the decision quite quickly that we needed to create a new company, which became Message Labs. So we ended up with two jobs in two companies, right? There was the CEO of both, the CCO, which is what I was, go-to-market guy of both, the CFO of both, Steve Chandler, who's the managing partner of Notion. Joss was the CMO of both. So, and we go from one ball beating to the next ball beating, driving these two businesses to meet the kind of challenges head on. And I think we can probably unpack bits of that. And
yeah, I mean, it sounds
your questions.
It sounds like, first of all, it sounds like you hit product market fit pretty quickly. So that's probably quite unique. And obviously the story then sort of exponentially grew, partially because of the times that we were living through at the time, where it was largely around fast adoption of technologies and therefore the requisite cybersecurity mapping that needs to go along with that sort of expansion, which there's a separate conversation there. Maybe we just take a small detour. Presumably you think that with the release of AI last year across a variety of different tools, that we're probably going to be seeing a similar explosion of cybersecurity tools in the way that you saw when all the devices and corporations went to emailing and other message forms.
Yeah, I think that's right. I just sent an email just before we jumped on this call about an opportunity that we've seen more recently that means the replacement of an SDR. So you don't need an SDR anymore. You just kind of use this technology. And trust me, as a go-to-market guy, if somebody enables that to work, I can't tell you how many hours, how many years I've spent trying to figure out how to scale the human side of go-to-market. You know, let's say you can directly attribute growth to the amount of quota capacity you have.
Yeah.
Right. And let's say you've got SDR quota capacity and then you've got the AE quota capacity. And you say, well, if I double my AEs and I double my SDRs and I find some productivity, then, you know, we're off to the races. We're going to gain market share faster than our competitors. But you try and go from 10 SDRs to 20 SDRs to 40 SDRs to 80 SDRs, right? It's incredibly difficult to be able to operationalize that at scale, if you see what I mean. If I can just now click more SDRs, that's kind of phenomenal. So I think a lot of the AI, for me, and the analogy for me is in the 90s, you know, there was this thing called the internet and we could build these things called websites. So all of a sudden there was this huge rush of capital to move into these websites. Some were undercapitalized and became incredible companies. Some were overcapitalized and died, you know, in the dot-com bust. So there is this huge wave of innovation and there are competing ideas about what works and what doesn't work or what will work or what won't work. But that's the great thing about venture. Inside that conundrum are going to be some kind of extraordinary companies built.
Yeah.
And some of our firmly held beliefs today will be found to be not true. And somewhere where you've got absolute conviction on a deal and you're absolutely certain that's the who it's going to build it and the way it's going to work is going to be like found wanting and it's not true. So I think it's just an incredible era.
So if,
we're about to enter.
If we look at some of those points that you just mentioned, which is a traditional problem that VCs have, which is to have strong views or thesis and then be proven wrong. And if we rewind the clock back to the Message Lab days, what were like the three takeaways that you took from that era that you had decided to be the underpinnings of you as an investor? When you walked out and you sold the company and you said, I'm going to start Notion, there must have been, you know, obviously it's hard to quantify them. You probably didn't write them down, but there must have been some three foundations, if you will, of these beliefs that you had, that if you could only pass those on to the founders you invested in, or if that's how you made investment decisions, it would totally make the difference between Notion being a tier four investing firm and a tier one investment firm.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good question. It's making me think quite hard. I think Message Labs is a really good example because the market really didn't believe that it would be successful. But we on the inside could see all the data. So when you switch that alpha on, that you had a bell on and you had to try and figure out who the hell put a bell on this thing. Every time it found a virus, and a noise would emit. So we had this high-pitched scream that was going on. So we had to try and figure out how to switch it off, right? So that was why we knew that we'd found something incredible. That doesn't necessarily mean that you can build a big company, but it means that you've got a chance. The second thing is the analysts, like, threw us out of their office for like 3 years. So we are acquiring customers, bundling it in as an ISP, creating this new company to go out direct to the market and then direct to the market. And meanwhile, there's this existing security industry, which is huge, that has its own cognitive bias about what works and what doesn't work. So this tin pot little company in Gloucestershire, you know, working out of a trading estate, right, in this little town, in this beautiful countryside, right? It's like we would ring up Verizon to say, do you want to become a partner of Message Labs? And they just fall about laughing. The analyst was throwing out. So the place where we kind of quite often go and get advice as VCs about this new founder that's got this very intriguing kind of technology proposition, quite often they don't see it. They don't want it to work. So I've become quite a kind of contrarian investor. And I try to figure out a way to, how do I intentionally make decisions about what I'm being told and why I'm being told things about a market. By default, I'm mistrusting of the information that I collect from the market, but it's from that direct experience from Message Labs where the security market just did not buy into what we were doing. However, we are seeing like tens and tens of customers connecting to this technology. We're seeing this huge percentage of email traffic that is viruses and then spam, which became the payload for viruses. So you've got these two worlds that are very, very different. You've got what the perceived experts are telling you is what's going on in the market, and then you've got what the data and your visceral experience is showing you is actually working. And so I think that's the first point. Well, it's actually 2 points in one. I think one is you've got to really work on your off thesis, and you've got to be mindful of the advice that you get from industry experts and think about how you pick through that. The second thing, I think, which is both the most meaningful thing for me in terms of my career that is in the book and that is very relevant to Message Labs and a whole bunch of the investments that we subsequently made, is the pain, right? It's like, who's banging the table to solve a problem? You know, we have these personas, we have these buyers, and they're very busy. They have a bunch of complex things that their business, their organization, their corporation is making them accountable to solve, right? And they have probably more problems than they have budget or resources available to fix those things. And many, many, many technology propositions are solving a problem that no one's really going to get fired for. No one's banging the table. And not all great investments are driven through pain, but some of the best ones, the ones where you get a very, very rapid shift of capital, happen because this is, you found a problem and a pain, you found a way to solve that in a perhaps an unusual way, a different way, not a better way. And you figure out how to build the value proposition around making a much larger audience of those buyers realize that this is kind of the way forward. And I think understanding the pain, problem, market fit, I always put the pain in that, trying to square that circle, right? So
what's not intended, but completely coincidental and lucky is that is the very first chapter of your book, titled The Pain Statement, The Value Proposition for the Team. And so it's ironic that it pretty much lines up with your experience is the number one chapter in your book. So this is a good opportunity to talk about the book and to switch gears a little bit and then go deeper into the chapters and why you drafted it and how it interplays with what you do at Notion and Included. And then we'll talk a little bit about Included towards the end. So first of all, the book itself, obviously widely available. It's titled The Go-to-Market Handbook for B2B SaaS Leaders. It's co-written with Paul Watson and Richard Blundell. And it's subtitled, How to Stack the Odds in Your Favor When Scaling Your SaaS Business. It's a very good read and it's a very easy read. So it's not like hyper complicated and, you know, hyper small fonts in a scary sort of textbook kind of way. But the interesting thing about it is that you've written it as a series of workbooks as opposed to chapters. What was the rationale behind that?
Well, Richard is the real prolific writer. So if I imagine him like a hod carrier, which is someone that used to carry bricks on their shoulders, you know, he's the one that's got all the words on his shoulders. He's the one that loves to express himself through. When we really debated it, we felt like, look, and we have this at Notion in terms of the way that we kind of think about businesses scaling, is that sometimes you're trying to put the puzzle together about what do I focus on as a founder or as a leader in a startup? And you've got some of the things that you've got really well refined and doing well, but there's these other bits of the jigsaw puzzle that you haven't done. So the ability to basically unpack that and say, oh, great, I need to figure out what my ICP is, my other customer profile. Oh, there's a workbook on that. So I can read that within an hour or two. And then I can immediately start to get to work and think, okay, team, look, you read this too. This is what I think. We really got all these different customers that are buying our technology for different reasons. And that's relatively hard to market to. And it's relatively unscalable in terms of how do you build a sales motion. So let's do that. And then, okay, great. Oh, we're going to have some fundraising, right? Oh, we've got fundraisings on the horizon, stuff like that. So let me just read this fundraising, which should actually at the end say, go read Carlos's book. Because the fundraising one was actually my most frustrating chapter and the one that I like the least, actually. And the reason why, to quote, is that this is a book all on its own. So, and thankfully you've provided that to the market, which it is fantastic. So it's the ability to think, I keep hearing this thing and this is a problem I feel like I need to get more aware of. I can go to that chapter. I can read that. It recommends other books. You know, it recommends other links. So there's a pretty comprehensive one on pricing and packaging, for example.
Well,
and
we're definitely going to jump into pricing.
Yeah. So, and you default to another resource then and say, great, I've got the headlines. I know what I think I need to understand. Now I can go deeper and I can go somewhere else to do that.
Yeah. Well, I love the format and I love the questions at the end, because I think, as you said, it sort of takes what is effectively a team exercise and allows you to break it out into team discussions, even though it is compounded together as a book, which is inevitable because that's how this stuff is packaged, right? But who is the customer? I think, you know, one of the interesting things that you talk about in Workbook 3 is defining your ideal customer. And one of the challenges with writing a book, and I had this challenge with Fundraising Field Guide, is calibrating who the audience is. Because if you're a second-time founder, there are always things to learn when it comes to fundraising. When I was writing my book, that are nuanced, especially if you're fundraising across geographies or with a different syndication strategy. But at the same time, you can lose people that are just starting out in their journey. And so it's hard. So tell us a little bit about who you wrote this book for and what were the calibration challenges that you had to factor in drafting it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think I'd bookend it a little bit. So I think you've built some lean canvases. And so you've got some thesis that's running in there in terms of the problem that you think you're trying to solve and who you're trying to solve it to, how you might get to them and stuff like that. And then you need to kind of test that thesis. And this book is perfect for you to go that kind of one, that next stage, and really start to noodle down on, okay, we're going to start to doing some customer development calls. We're going to start to figure out exactly, you know, is there a common problem met by a common identified set of buyers or personas? And then, you know, what's the words, what's the language that they're using? And then what are the other alternatives that they're using? What's the technology infrastructure that they're playing with? So you can kind of get into the meat of, like, I tend to think about it as go slow to go fast. You know, quite often as entrepreneurs, we rush in. Our idea is profoundly brilliant in our own mind. We start hiring people. We start going to market. We hire a salesperson. And actually, we start to get frustrated. And I think you'll have found that the best founders in the world, or the difference between the good ones and the best ones, is that the great ones have that idea and they push themselves into market, but then they start to obsess about what's happening with the customer. They start to obsess about their daily life, what they do, who they do it with, the technologies that they use. So I think there's the post the lead canvas, stuff like that. And I think it's pre Series B. You know, by the time we get to the Series B, we always get, you know, there's always examples of where this is not the case, but by the time you get to sort of Series B or beyond in the sort of in a standard world, not necessarily a 2021 world, then the market has decided you've figured out a great team or a team for that stage. The investors have figured it out and you've got the right people around the table. The traction is happening and stuff like that. And maybe you're kind of tweaking around the edges and you're getting to multiple products, multiple markets fit, that type of aspect. And that's beyond this book, I think. So I think if you're building lean canvases and figuring out what to do next, I think the book is perfect. I think if you're trying to reconcile how you become a more meaningful investment proposition to a Series A, pre-Series B investor, then the book still holds great water. But before and after, I don't think that the book is focused for that audience.
Fair enough. All right. Well, I wanted to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about the chapters themselves and the flow. I'm just going to read the titles just because it's probably worthwhile for anybody who's considering buying it, but also just sort of wanting to understand what's covered. So the first workbook is called Reconfirming Your Value Proposition Internally. We talked a little bit about how this is one of the lessons you learned at Message Labs, is that pain statement. Then the next one is Testing Your Thesis. Workbook 3 is Defining Your Ideal Customer. Workbook 4 is Building the Market Map. Workbook 5, Sharpening Up Your Product Messaging. Workbook 6, Creating Demand for Your Software. Number 7, when and how should you hire a sales team? Number 8, selling your software. Number 9, how to price and package your software. And lastly, building a great investor proposition. And we're going to go into a few of those for the remaining of the podcast. But I wanted to first off ask you, why this specific structure? Because as I was reading it, I realized that, for example, you referenced pricing super early on some points, but then pricing is towards the end. And then there's stuff like hiring a sales team in advance of founder-led sales. And so I just wanted to understand, is there a logic to this flow?
Or is it emotional? I think it's one of those things that when you're writing it, it seems pretty logical. But then when you kind of step back and you take audience feedback, then it's like, oh, you know, I think pricing is a really interesting one. And we're lucky, as I said earlier, to have an incredible pricing guy on the team. And when we were at Message Labs, one of the things that some people know really well and not people are aware of, because everything looks, you know, when you build a really big company, everyone thinks it looks really sheeny, shiny and easy from the outside looking in. But on the inside, it's an absolute, not a cluster, but it's like, you know, it's people are leaning into the growth challenges. In year one, we were 90% off plan. So we missed our plan by 90%. This was by the end of the third quarter. And the strategy that we had deployed was faultless in many regards, because it reflected about how we had found the problem and built the technology in the first place. So we were fully indirect. So we were signing up. We signed up half the ISPs in Europe. And we felt that that was the best place to distribute the security proposition, because we had an ISP and it was going unbelievably well. But they were busy doing other things. They didn't really care. And the average order value was too small. You know, they're selling 30K tickets and we were, let's say, a 3K ticket. So, and it was actually a little bit complex to sell this. So we had to, and the nuances of go-to-market won't get into, but we then made the decision to go direct sales with indirect fulfillment. And that might sound, well, isn't that the same as indirect? And but it's actually a little different. The other problem that we had at the time was pricing. In the first 9 months, we had people that couldn't sell it for more than, let's just 10p per user, and we had people that wouldn't sell it for less than £1 per user. So our pricing was pretty embryonic. We did a massive restructure. We went direct with indirect fulfillment. We moved the pricing to £1 per user, and we hired 3 people to shift from indirect to direct. And so all of these problems were interconnected. They didn't sit in isolation. And what happened is we went on this incredible bull run of bookings that was extraordinary. Our pricing went from £1 a user to £4 per user until a large competition came in, and then it started to come down a little bit. And so sometimes I think, like I said earlier, you're a founder or an operator and you're sitting here and you've got some of the jigsaw puzzle, and you know that you feel strong about some of that jigsaw puzzle, how the business is going to scale. But there are other bits that you don't feel comfortable with. It would have been very easy for us to have been a business that stayed indirect, that distributed the technology at 10p per user and had an entirely different strategy. There are so many options that you have. And so it doesn't matter too much how the book is constructed from a chapter. You've just got to say, right, I think this is a problem that I've got. I need to orientate myself around that challenge, if you see it. And you know what this is like at Seedcamp, right? When you used to put us all in a room with your founders, right? Someone's going, hey, go direct, go indirect, go SME, go enterprise, go freemium. And the founder's got to figure it out, right? And so the workbook effectively allows them to kind of go through a process for them to sort of assemble, okay, now I can feel like this is a sprint I'm going to go on. This, I'm going to make a decision about this in pricing, and I'm going to live with that, and I'm going to review it, and I'm going to have feedback loops.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do that about go-to-market, and I'm going to wait about that on hiring, because I need to be more confirmed that this is right before I then hire someone who I think is right for that problem and stuff like that. And so,
Fair enough. And I think that goes nicely with the workbook format, right? So, all right, well, let's dig into a few of these. And I think we were just chatting about pricing, so might as well just stick with that. You start off the chapter with talking about how many startups underprice. And that is a consistent advice that VCs tell startups, hey, why don't you price higher? You're undervaluing yourself. And in the book, you go through that chapter by starting with determining value, and you have a series of questions. Let me pick out a few of them. They're very good. It's how often are your customers logging in? Which internal departments are they in? Do different personas in the business find different value, user versus executive? Where has this saved time, money, and heartache? What would they like the software to do that it currently doesn't? And there's more. I just read a few. But effectively, you're trying to calibrate value to the organization. You then go through outlining the ways that you can package that value, whether it be user-based or usage-based or modular or through free, medium, enterprise. And you go through that in detail. But what's really interesting is that you get to the point where you talk about price sensitivity. I mean, you don't call it that in the chapter, but you're effectively trying to figure out how much somebody willing to pay at max, min, et cetera. And this is where I get stuck, because I understand how you're trying to calibrate value. I understand how you can package it. But the whole problem is that if you calibrate on the perceived value subjectively from the users, you're always going to be underpricing it. So maybe you can help start unpacking that problem. It's a circular reference, and I don't know how to fix it.
Yeah, I think, and it's also super dynamic, right? Because I think there's a strategy that sits above this that definitely dramatically impacts the way that you kind of think about pricing. For example, if you feel like it's a foot race for market share and you create pricing as a hurdle, then maybe you consume less customers, right? You get less customers on your juice because you've got a bigger hurdle to get over, and a competitor that's got a completely different strategy might gain large market share by lowering the barriers to adoption and then increasing the prices once they've got them on the juice. So I think pricing in isolation, you see a lot of startups following a fairly typical path, which is a pricing page that will have starter package, medium package, and kind of enterprise package, which is pretty outdated. And you see this kind of emergence today of a lot of really exciting pricing packages, which are around consumption-based pricing, which at Notion, we have a pretty decent weighting in our kind of portfolio that are more consumption-based pricing. And those two things can hang together. So you can have subscription and consumption-based pricing and lots of other variations. So I think what we're trying to encourage people to do is two things. I think we're trying to understand, and actually comes from the pain statement that's earlier in the book, which is to really continue to understand customers better than anyone else is going to understand these customers. And then look at the data in terms of exactly, you know, what are they using it from a data perspective, but also the customer development is why they're using it, and trying to create themes. And so you can then start to think about, how do I price to see the things that they really care about? Now, some of that can be making the product simpler, right? We see a lot of examples where the product becomes increasingly more complicated, has a bigger surface space that has an overhead associated with it, but actually isn't valued by customers, or customers in a certain segment that you're trying to address. So the book is very much about encouraging people to think about the customer development cycle again, as well as the data that they're seeing in terms of the way that people are locking in, and thinking through those stories that they can, you can see there and say, okay, this is what our customers are saying that they really care about. This is the evidence that suggests this is exactly what they do care about, and trying to look between those nuances and then thinking about how you price. Now, the book actually does lean a little bit towards value-based pricing, which implies that you're going to be able to increase the pricing that you're extracting from the customer for the value that you're delivering. For me as a strategist, I tend to think before that. So I tend to think, look, do we want to just lower the barriers to entry from a pricing perspective? And we want to drive a lot more market share so that we want to be the dominant force in terms of customers that acquired a percentage of market share. And then second horizon, then start to layering in higher pricing or more extraction costs for them buying that technology or using that technology. So I think, for me, one has to think kind of those things through. Again, like a sprint, about for the strategy that we have now for the next 12, 18 months, you know, what's the strategy we're going to go for? Is it more market share, or is it more value extraction, if you see what I mean? So
in your portfolio, do you have any good anecdotes of how you've had a company start off with that sort of market dominance position with a certain pricing strategy, calibrating relative to competitors, and then changing that?
Yeah, there's a famous story at Notion, which actually is for Triptease, which is in the hotel space. And this was pre-deal. I think the founder, Charlie Osmond, is like, he's an incredible guy. And this was his second or third business. And he was using social media, so creating checkout cards for people that spent time in hospitality in the hotel, etc., to push out on social media and see whether that would impact the traffic to the website. And so a lot of the value of and revenue associated with being a hotelier is passed over to a booking.com, right? And so direct bookings was becoming a narrative in that market. And so we were doing lots of whiteboard sessions at Notion, which we do, you know, it's like free consulting. You know, we're not an investor at this point in time. We're just noodling away and thinking about what's this founder up to? What's this team doing? And they actually came back with like a website pop-up. When we talked about 50% of bookings are going direct, they came with a pop-up that when you're actually looking at a booking.com, you often go to the hotel website because the photographs are better. So they've done a lot of customer development around figuring out the human behavior of looking for a hotel to go on holiday or to visit. And they said, what we're thinking is if we put a pop-up on the hotel website that shows the pricing in the OTAs and that we're never more expensive, then we think there will be a change of behavior. So I said, listen, I think just the process we've gone through is genius. Did a pre-seed or a seed check. And 3 months later, they launched that thing and just the market loved it. It went bonkers. But the challenge is obviously the depth of the product is really thin. So we agreed that the big problem was how do you strategically think that through in terms of go-to-market and packaging and pricing? So initially they could have charged quite a lot, but what they actually did is they drove the price right down and they started to sign hundreds of hotels a quarter. Whilst they built in the debt of the product. And that was the first real growth wave that business went through. And so you're kind of thinking through is that if what I've done in 3 months has had such a massive response, it's pretty easy to copy that technology. And so is it better to extract a large amount for that sale or actually do you drive the price down, drive more volume of market share and then build the defensibility in after. So that would be a very, very specific example of...
That's a very good question to open up the conversation around building a great investor proposition, which is your 10th chapter. Because in the one on pricing and packaging, you go into determining your costs and unit economics. And what you just described is perhaps very scary for a founder in light of when they might need to fundraise. Because you're now taking a strategy which erodes perceived unit economics, erodes revenue generation, which means that the metrics and the ARR doesn't look good. Even though you have this latent strategy you're going to activate, you go to the market to fundraise with effectively weak metrics. And even if it might be the right pricing strategy to dominate long term. So how do you reconcile some of these pricing strategies, go-to-market strategies with the unfortunate pressure that when you go fundraise for your next round, that you're going to have to showcase things that means that you can monetize, that you can drive revenue. And I'd like for you to answer from the point of view of the advice that you give to founders versus what a sort of erudite VC should be looking at to really dig deep, which is unfortunately not everyone in our ecosystem.
That tees me up nicely. So I think we know statistically that 99% of founders should not raise VC capital. So VC capital is an extremely niche type of financing. And so, you know, frequently the advice that we're giving to founders is that they shouldn't be raising VC capital. In fact, what they should be doing is they should be building an incredible company for their users or their buyers, you know, their customers, the markets that they operate in, their team. And so we're just kind of one lens. The VCs are just one lens. You know what it's like? You get a new investor at the Series B and then they want the business to be managed in a different way to extract a load of take a lot of things out, like the professional services line or whatever, which the customers might love, right? And so there's not really a straightforward answer apart from you've got to know who you're building the company for. And if you get that wrong, if you build your company for me as a VC and all the other VCs like me and the better VCs, far better VCs than me, then you've got to be really careful about how dislodged you are from fundamentally what your customers really want from you. I actually think, you know, you have those brave and kind of courageous founders and Ben and Joss White definitely in this category where, for example, exit strategies, you know, so we talk about TAMs and we talk about exit strategies and stuff like that. And would very deliberately be, look, we don't even think about our exit strategy. Right. All we care about is, are we solving genuinely a real profound problem for our customers? Do we do that in a very, very highly repeatable, safe way that makes them feel secure as a security proposition? Do we do that better than anybody else, right? And if we do that, then we're creating a lot of scale and people will want to invest in our company. And there's people like, you know, Amazon, right? Which like, we are not going to make profits for a very, very long period of time. We need investors that are going to come on the journey, if you see what I mean. So I think it's always the founders that are able to kind of intellectually make us investors incredibly subservient to the mission that they're on. And they're not overly rendering their opportunity to our benefit to make us feel good about the fact that they're following our trodden path. What they're actually doing is they're building a great company that customers love, that are willing to pay more or buy it faster, or the reasons why they don't churn or leave. They use the product in anger. Those are all the things that genuinely count for a founder. And yeah, at some point you're going to go into a sprint of fundraising and you're going to think about, you know, how you play that story narrative into us as an audience in terms of as an investment proposition. But that's not who you're building the company for. So that's kind of the way I think about that.
Yeah, fair enough. You know, fair enough. It's not the right way to build it, but it is a source of tension, right? It is a source of tension between knowing that you're going to be held to account on that by a variety of people, even if at the very end, you hopefully find the right investor who can see past it. And I guess that means that us as investors, we're looking for founders who can tell a story around that, who can walk us through what it is that they have decided to do and why they've decided to do that. And when you go through in the chapter on selling your software, one of the things that you go through is the Medic framework, and hopefully you can talk about that for a little bit. But you also discuss this issue about economic buyers versus champions. And presumably, if you do that well, you can articulate why it is that you've chosen a certain pricing strategy, a certain unit economic strategy to cater to one type of buyer or a champion that then enables another type of buyer and champion to take over the long term of the company. So maybe walk us through a little bit on the Medic framework and how you've seen it implemented by companies you work with. And then also how you judge founders when they share with you a version of why they've chosen the strategy they've chosen.
Yeah, I think in terms of Medic, I grew up in sales. So my functional disposition is sales and go to market back in the day. So lots of method or sales methodologies has evolved over that, what is it, too long, 30-year period. So, you know, Medic stands for like metrics, economic buyer, decision criteria, decision process, identify pain and the champion. And so it's more people will be thinking about that in terms of mid-enterprise, enterprise and extremely large enterprise sales rather than, you know, product-led growth type business fundamentally. Different sales motion. And so complex sales, you know, basically what you're trying to figure out is there are more people in that organization that are able to say yes or no. So there's a buying cycle, there's a selling cycle, and there's a kind of procurement cycle. I don't know how many the most amount of signatures I've ever had to get from selling or buying a technology, but I definitely know that it's 17 or above. It's certainly something like that. At Message Labs, we had all of the government and Secret Service emails running through our infrastructure. So we can open those emails, we can look at those emails, we can test that they are or not malicious or something's squiffy about them. And so, you know, that was kind of a long, convoluted buy cycle. And so it unpacks and picks that to think about, okay, so if I've got these long buying cycles that might be 6, 9, 12, 18 months long, and I want to figure out how do I operationalize a sales organization and go to a market organization, and how do I make that faster? How do I increasingly spend less capital on that? So the capital that is invested in a sales cycle and stuff like that. Then Medic is one of the methodologies to use that, because you need to cover a lot of bases in order to make that product sell, and also the non-product related services that enterprises want sold in order to buy that technology as well, which is the professional kind of services element there. Now, if I post anything about Medic, which is really funny, all the medic nuts come back at me and they go, well, what about MedHic? And what about, you know, it's a beast all of its own. It has about 7 different variants today. And so the book really touches on exposing that to founders so they can think about that maybe for the first, second, third time. And then again, as is with the book, there are resources that they then can again go to and then become more of an expert, if that makes any sense. Same with pricing. Andreas and our team has got the Principles of Pricing website, which is an incredible resource that we built that people can go and get into pricing very, very quickly from that. So
maybe as part of this chapter, just to conclude, what is the biggest assumption about founder-led sales that you've seen done wrong by founders you back early days?
Well, I think there's
an anecdote, it'd be great. Even if you anonymize anecdote, it'd be great.
You know, the joke that we all have is the joke would be that I'm in the company, right? I'm not talking about one of my investments here. So this would be like a Message Lab story, is that sometimes the founders are the great evangelists, right? They embody the company and the technology. They've had gazillions conversations with other people and themselves, their own mind, about what it is and what it's not. And they're really good evangelists in front of the customer. And so the customer comes out and they're highly motivated and they're like, wow, that's amazing. I've just met this incredible guy. And then they get back to their job, which is all the other priorities that they've got. And the founder thinks they've done an amazing job. And the sales guy's sitting there thinking, oh my God, we don't know anything about their circumstances. We haven't gone through detailed level questioning and stuff like that. He's just half the price and stuff like that. So that could have been me. It could have been Joss. It could, you know, and so I have an incredible, great respect for the sort of sales profession and, you know, what they do, how they do it, and the best in the market. And so they'll have a little bit of an eye roll, right? So there's the good thing about getting the founder in the room, and then there's the gotcha, what's the bad reason to get them? And generally, it's lowering the price, right? That tends to be, they premature articulate, as we used to say. And that said, you know, some founders are incredible. You know, they're at selling, and people forget they sell to us VCs, and we write pretty large checks out in pretty embryonic thesis of a company. And that is an incredible skill. I mean, the ROI on that skill is remarkable. And if that's one thing some people can take away, if you really learn that craft, then the ROI on you being able to sell your company to somebody that shouldn't be joining your company at that part of their career, or to an investor who, you know, you're trying to get a logical person to do a really illogical thing, which is invest in your business at that time and that stage, put theirs and other people's money at risk. If you're able to sell to an enterprise customer or a corporate or a buyer that's got a pain and they're going to go on a journey with you as a customer and put their reputation at risk internally for buying your technology, that's just the ROI and that skill is just kind of immense. And people do it in different ways. You know, Steve Jobs used to do the big reveal. Benioff would tell the story. He would kind of almost provide a completely new way for you to kind of think about the company that you were running as a customer. You know, you're the customer first organization, or you're the digital business for your industry, for the next generation. So every year he would kind of completely reinterpret for customers the way they thought about the business that they were running on their technology, if you see what I mean. So there's lots of different ways of doing it, but I think it's just one of those great ROI skills. Even, you know, you're one of the best in the world at extracting money from LPs. So
come on, Chris. I wanted to shift to the last section to cover as part of your book, but before we wrap up the whole book part of this interview, one of the things that I found really interesting was the chapter on creating demand for your software, because first of all, I do think it's a great pairing with the one before it, with sharpening up your product messaging. The two things are very highly related, right? You know, you go through the prospect stages, you talk about tools that people can use, including Gripped and Sixth Sense, which are really great. I check them out. In the book, you have the links and everything. But there was two things that you covered that I wanted to go deeper into, and partially related to founder-led sales. It's this idea of dark social, or this idea of content, or this idea of downloadable documents that can pre-sell your software because people talk about it. And there's always a challenge there, right? First challenge is that sometimes it has to be founder-driven, or it has to be created by the very people who are building product, which can be a distraction from like 500 other things. That's the first challenge. The second challenge is nailing the product messaging before you do this, because it, like, for you to come up with a white paper, for you to come up with anything, it's not as quick as some SEO that you test and A/B test and stuff. Like, it can be quite time consuming to mess up and waste that time. And then lastly, the breadcrumbs of returns on dark social are completely unquantifiable, which means your colleagues might be like, you're wasting your time. What are you doing with this stuff? And yet, in your book, you highlighted as a key element of creating demand. So maybe you can unpack any anecdotes of how it was managed in the very best of cases, and when you know you've gone off piste as a founder.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think the first thing is linked to founder-led sales. So in the book, we talk about the first sales hire that you should probably hire is an account manager. So somebody like a customer success type account manager. So you're making it really easy. You know, you've got the hunters and the farmers, if you see what I mean, in sales language of old, right? But then this subdivides even further now. But if your initial customers don't absolutely love and rave about your service, then you've got a problem there, right? You're not going to have incredible word of mouth marketing, but you're already going down a low growth cul-de-sac in the end. You might have a spurt and do well, but then it's going to slow down. So you've got the founder, and you've got this customer success oriented account manager, not a hunter, if that makes any sense, to sort of get that thing more. Then that's the first part. So that's this kind of internal view. Now, the external view in terms of how people live their lives out there in the world, who are in businesses that have problems, and the birds of a feather that flock together, right? We have all these wonderful, highly connected tools that we use, like WhatsApp, which is where I live most of my day. It's in WhatsApp, not email or anything else. And they can kind of communicate. And that's the sort of first way of thinking about, you know, social that doesn't exist within the realms of your own data infrastructure or data, right? It's not your website hits. It's not your funnel and stuff like that. It's what people are talking about and saying about you when you're not in the room, right? And the biggest example of this is when we tried to take down one of the biggest banks as a customer at Message Labs. We talked to them about the expense of a large enterprise size cycle. It's extremely long. As VCs, I worry about how much money do I need to deploy into those sales cycles, if you see what I mean. And so, but those big enterprises, like let's just pick on someone like a Barclays Bank as an example, they all have this huge chain of small operating businesses that have very different buying cycles to the main bank. And if you take a company like that, they might have 200 up to 200 different companies that are buying technology, the same technology, potentially independently. And let's say it's a CIO that you're selling to. Well, those CIOs will get together once a year, maybe once a quarter. And one of the questions will be, oh, what technology have you bought that's like really solved the massive issue for you? And we took down, I think, probably 80% of all the biggest banks in the UK would have been customers of Message Labs. How we won nearly all of those banks was selling to one of those small organizations that sat within their corporate structure. I think there was one which was the trust services of Bank X of Jersey. And he messaged us to say, by the way, I've just been at the CIO grouping for Bank X and I was raving about your technology. And, you know, I want to introduce you to six or seven of the buyers in the group of this bank. And this is how the world operates. So we can look at our website, we can see our hits, we can see our hand raisers, we can download our white papers and stuff like that. But there's this whole other world that's happening out in the real world, right? And you trying to figure out how you kind of play into that. And so, you know, I'm talking about these banks for Message Labs, which would have been back in 2001, 2002, you know, pre-social media and stuff like that. So the world is not just the screen that you're looking at, the software that's managing your CRM. The world is actually completely operating independently of that. And that's how you kind of play into that, I think, is really, really important. And just to finish on that point, the biggest drug in business is winning. A team that is built a product that's being bought and loved. And there are two things that I've always obsessed in my career. One is the amount of employees that have got unbelievable levels of discretionary effort. So they don't work their contract. They're on the mission. And the other one is word of mouth marketing. Is what are customers saying about you when you're not in the room? Who are they telling? What are they saying? And, you know, when a customer buys your product, gets promoted and leaves, and buys your product and gets promoted and leaves. But one key part of what they do in every organization is they reconsume your product for that new organization. And, you know, that's when you know that you've got the employee discretionary effort and you've got customer discretionary effort. And those two things together, that to me feels like a really real winning company.
It is, but I think it, you know, just to iterate on the final part of the question, which is around founder balance, because somebody's got to do that. And it's not always clear that it's somebody you can delegate it to. And it's much more time consuming than sitting in on a sales call and 20 minutes, like telling your story and passionately getting people on board. This is now like a project, right? And you can really mess it up because it ends up sort of, as you said, dark social, ends up everywhere for years to come. So how do you recommend thinking about a strategy here of creating that CIO conversation once a year through these sort of indirect strategies, balancing founder time with every other responsibility?
Well, I think you might be talking about two things there. Are you talking about founder balance, or are you talking about how to utilize it as a part of a go-to-market strategy?
It's the founder balance. I think if I look at it from the founder's point of view, and I don't want to name names, but I think we know a couple of founders that we've worked with where this is a challenge. It's like, hey, I'm not only calibrating the product messaging, then articulating that into like a long form set of materials that is consumed by the potential customer, then the feedback cycle for that, and then calibrating that vis-a-vis hiring a salesperson just to make calls, being at sales meetings, and or just focusing on other things that are operational. And it seems like, you know, in your book, you cover how valuable it is. And the problem is that that value is so hard to capture and look at the metrics for its return on investment that it gets deferred. And yeah. So you have two conflicting ideas in the book, this idea that it's so valuable, and yet at the same time, you can't quantify it. So how the hell do you balance it?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. I've actually got a founder at the moment that is, and I endorse the fact that he's continued to do founder-led sales because he's unbelievable about it, but he's also running a fundraising process at the same time. I have no idea how he does this because it's like a superhuman effort that inevitably puts you into sort of a difficult zone. I would come back to the way that you kind of think about employees. And this is one of the big parts of my life is that I've been fascinated about the untapped potential of people. And what I mean by that is that, you know, Price's law is probably the law that's driven my career more than anything else, which is the square root law. So it means that as companies scale, incompetence grows more non-linearly. So if you've got a 100-person company, then 10 people of that will produce 50% of the value. So if you have 10,000 people in the company, it's 100. So you can see the sort of dynamic there. So I tend to think about the relationship between a boss and an employee, or a company and their managers, and the managers and the employees is very differently. I think about it as a partnership. Everyone thinks that employees are on permanent contracts, which they are, but they are not permanent in companies. That's why attrition is so big. In reality, what happens is the employees, particularly those that are ambitious and high performing, what they're looking for is an experience about, you know, what's in it for me. They tend to think more like an investor, right? They're thinking, I'm going to join this company and I'm going to go on a sprint. And at the end of that sprint, I'm going to learn a lot. I'm going to work with some good and great people, some bad people. And I'm going to come out of that as a, you know, my unit value is going to be higher. And the manager, if the manager thinks like that too, then I think there's an incredible partnership. So I think with the founder in the founder-led sales point is that if you think about the people that you surround yourself with as employees, then that's the first problem. I think if you think about them as like, look, we're on a mission and you're only going to be able to retain these people statistically for a couple of years. Now, we all spend all of our time trying to think how we make it longer, but the reality is the only way to make that longer is to form a partnership with that person. What's in it for the employee? What's in it for the founder? What's in it for the manager? What's in it for the peer managers? What's in it for the... And it's like, when you work with ambitious people, you know the biggest problem that you have is how do you retain them? So I tend to think that, for example, if you take the founder-led sales and sales organizations, you've really got to give people some form of autonomy to build a little piece of your business. And, you know, an obvious way to do that, that we've done many times before, is that you become not just a sales AE, but you own a vertical market, for example. But that means that you're going to start to build relationships with journalists, with publications, with the things that you might post on LinkedIn, and you're going to start to own that increasingly more. Now, this might be a 24, 25-year-old, you know, highly ambitious, very capable, self-learning, hard-driving kind of individual. And not only if you start to spin those up, then you learn a lot as a founder and as a team, because they bring a lot to the game, if you see what I mean. Then I think that's how you create a much more scalable organization. If you can't do that, then the founder imbalance will just go forever. It will consume the founder. So I tend to think about it in terms of the way that you think about the relationship between the company, the founder, the managers, leaders, and the employees. You have to really rethink the way that you think about that in order to make it very, very scalable. I think so.
Yeah. So it is a dynamic, basically, experience. And it sounds like it's a conversation, frankly. It sounds like there's a lot of trust that you're having to inject into that equation, because even though it could be a huge driver for sales down the road, it's just unquantifiable. So you need to have trust from your colleagues that the time is well spent. And probably sounds like there's a lot of conversations around what should be the priorities for each one of the team members.
Yeah, I mean, as you can tell, I'm the kind of opposite to command and control. And obviously there are many examples where that's exactly the right type of leadership context that's needed. But in early stage startups, there's still some of that that might be required. But in the main, you know, I tend to default to delegated authority, providing people with the tools, the accountability, the power of suggestion around what is it they, the employee, wants to build, not me telling them what I think they should do, if you see what I mean. So I tend to spend a lot more time thinking about building companies in that direct methodology rather than the other. So
nice. Well, just to conclude on the book, I just wanted to ask you one fun question about your perception of the book in terms of what parts of it you wrote for yourself as a catharsis of your experience in Message Labs. What parts of it would you read back to young Chris and be like, dude, read these chapters, man?
I think it's the go slow to go fast. You just got to really understand customers. There's too many situations where the relationship with the customer is transactional. And maybe in some markets, that's right. I think when you really get into the minds of buyers and what's really going through their mind, that I think we put, like, you know, that 3 a.m. in the morning, right? You're staring at the ceiling. The monologue in your head is haywire. There's anxiety and fear about something. If I don't solve this problem, am I going to get fired? If we don't solve this problem, what's going to happen to the company? If you can find those problems, you can line up your team that you all have chipped away at all the other things that you could be or might be, if you see what I mean, and you start to think about how do we innovate around solving that problem for that buyer. And then you find a novel way to be able to do that, not a better thing, a different thing is my preference. Then I think you spend enough time of your career going round and round that, then at some point you're going to hit an incredible opportunity to solve, which then gives you a chance to build a big company and go on a mission with some people. So that's the kind of go slow to go fast, I think, is the way. That's it. Mm. It's okay. Keep asking the right questions. Keep putting yourself in the right places. Keep doing the feedback loops and then start to kind of chip away, chip down. So
fair enough. Fair enough. All right. Well, to wrap things up, I just wanted to give you a chance to plug Notion, what kind of founders you're looking for, and also to plug and share a little bit about what Included VC is and what kind of associates / prospective Included members you're looking for.
A plug? I wasn't expecting a plug.
Plug, of course.
Well, listen, Notion is the B2B SaaS investor in Europe. and got formed an incredible team. What I love about Notion, for me, I write a thing which is Notion is a way of life. The way that I try to help me think about why we do what we do, why we're an enduring business, what motivates and drives us. One of our values is playing the long game. So we tend to think of ourselves as more than a fund. And so that links to Included. We've managed to raise, I think, over $1 billion now across 5 venture funds. And we've just got an incredible appetite to find those unusual people that are facing impossible odds. And they want to, you know, founder operator led firm to go on the journey with them. So I think that one's quite straightforward. I think Included VC is quite personal. I think, as I said at the beginning, you know, I'm a working class kid from the wrong side of the tracks. I think if you read the social commentary that exists today, there are so many voices that are saying that the statistical odds are stacked against us, people from different backgrounds. And yet here I've managed to navigate my way into an incredibly privileged position. So I like to build things that are more edifying. How do you bring people together? How do they share and collaborate and learn together? And I think when you bring the industry together, firms like Notion, Seedcamp, Preandum, who put back into the system, and then we have this incredible female CEO, Nikita, who I don't know how she does it. She builds this huge pipeline of applications, like 5,000 people around the world. And we all kind of work together to try and chip that down to something typically around 60 to 75 people join the program from around the world, from all sorts of different backgrounds, incredibly diverse, 85, maybe even higher now. And percent of those that continue to want to get into VCs. And some people say, hey, do you know what? Now I know what it's all about. It's not for me, but you know, get a job in VC. And it's really personal for me because, like I said, I want to build places where people have the opportunity to share and collaborate, and the industry pros get to help people or align with people that are from different backgrounds from all around the world. And it's incredibly successful. So, you know, it's meaningful for me on a really personal level. And I know it's very meaningful for many of the people that go through the program, but also contribute to the program in terms of time and money and experience and stuff. So,
which include us for the record.
Seedcamp, 100%. Yeah.
Included VC. I love it. I love the sessions and I look forward to doing more.
I know. And I was saying only earlier this morning, I've got a mentoree in Included, and she is like the most remarkable person. Like, I was like, when was the last time I had a session like this with someone? And so they are incredibly inspiring. And I always used to say that you start these things and you think, oh, I'm putting back, I'm giving back into the system. And it's like those movies in the US where actually, you know, they take in maybe an orphan or something or whatever, and actually it's the orphan saving the family, right? And that's what I feel. I have mentoring sessions with the fellows, and actually, you know, they're saving us, right? They have an incredible impact on the way that we think, on the way we feel about what we do, and in the opportunities that we want to open up to people. And so it's a great organization. I'm very proud for everybody that's involved in it. And it's an important part of, you know, what I do. And
keep on doing it. To you, to Joss, the entire Notion team and the Included team, just wanted to thank you for all that great work all these years. And, you know, even building Message Labs, which put a lot of European SaaS on the market. So thanks for all that great work. If you are listening to this podcast, remember this is the book, The Go-to-Market Handbook for B2B SaaS Leaders. It's a good starting framework for dealing with all the burning questions that you should be asking yourself. So with that, guys, thank you, Chris, for joining us. And until next time.
Thanks, Carlos. Thanks, everyone.